The Echo Chamber, brought to you by The Holmes Report and produced by the international broadcast specialist Marketeers.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. This is Arun Sudharman. We're here in Davos, the World Economic Forum 2019, and I'm joined by Marion Saltzman, who is the Chief Communications Officer at Philip Morris International. Marion, welcome.
Thanks for having me. In fact, I think my title is Senior Vice President Communications, okay. And I only bring that up because the very idea, I do serve as a lead communicator, but the very idea that Philip Morris would have someone with the title Communications is probably the entryway into anything we could talk about.
I'm sure it certainly is, and thank you anyway for providing us with the correct title. Already my research is is found to be wanting. So first of all, before we get into it, I've got to ask you this question, a little bit of a test. Do you remember the last time you were on this Echo Chamber podcast?
I believe you taped it in some Havas office. I want to say it was in Paris.
Yeah, well done.
Okay, so see, my long-term memory is not fading and my medium-term memory is okay. This is actually, it made me just feel good about my aging.
And do you remember when it was?
It was going to have to be at least 5 years ago.
I think it was 2013, autumn.
So five and a half. Okay, perfect.
Yeah, so you were at Havas. And you ascended to the role of, I think you were chairman
of the Global Collective, and we were actually, it was the first time we convened, if I recall correctly, the global leaders to begin to talk about how to be collaborative and consistent in terms of tools.
Right, correct, and become one brand. I feel that was one of the goals, perhaps.
Which is so interesting, because now as the buyer of PR services, my constant rant and rave is, I can find absolutely awesome agencies in specific markets, and it is very difficult to find any kind of uniformity of either their style of working or the work itself, quality of work itself.
So does that mean you would rather just buy best in market agencies rather than looking for this kind of network brand across the world?
No, it means I'm desperately searching for that network or networks, because in our case, there will never be an individual solution. Mm-hmm. There are markets in which we work with local or regional players, mm-hmm. and if they're not broken, I'm not going in there to break something. But overall, I think our goal is very much to find single solutions against our corporate, single solutions against crisis, single solutions against consumer.
Okay. So why do you think there is such a challenge for network agency brands to provide that consistent experience as someone who's been on both sides of the fence?
You know, I'm very schizophrenic in my response because as a former agency leader, I always assumed our best offices would bring the others up to par on a specific assignment. And now, as a buyer of services, I discovered that the weakest office tends to drag the whole system down.
Yeah.
So it's really, I think, a matter of we need to learn to be better clients, no question about that. But also agencies need to tell us when they don't have, if you can't mount a campaign for me in Germany or in Russia before you bring in an affiliate's affiliate, just come and tell me, no, go back to your local resource. Right. And I think that's the, you know, it's hard. I understand as an agency leader, you're being judged quarterly, you're being judged against EBIT, you're being judged against growth targets. I understand why you want to be, and you're always optimistic, oh, it's going to be great.
Yeah.
And then the reality of what it's going to be, I think, is the next challenge.
Okay. Sorry, just watch your hair. It's touching the mic.
Yeah.
Sorry. So it's a process of osmosis. The best agencies lift up the
I always thought it was the best agencies would lift up. So at Havas, we were obviously great in France, we were great in Australia.
Yeah.
We were very strong in the US and in stronger in certain categories and other categories. We were very strong in Manchester, for example. And I always felt, well those agencies can step in.
Pittsburgh
is, I mean, it's a classic high performer for Havas. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember Paul Holmes said to me when I first got there, don't mess it up. And that was literally his, I had lunch with him very early on in my tenure, and he had a few things to say, and his primary thing was, Katie McSorley and that team are doing a damn good job, don't mess it up. And I think it was very useful advice. It reminds me, many years before that, when I went into WPP, I went to Y&R, And someone's called me and said, Mary, no matter what you do, don't say anything provocative at MetLife. They've been here since the 1930s.
Right.
And it was, but I think there is a sense that all the agencies would rise to that level of competency. So, I mean, in the case of Pittsburgh, they were an extraordinary B2B provider.
Yeah.
In the case of the little agency we'd created in Phoenix, they're an amazing consumer agency because they're working in that restaurant and food space day in and day out. But when you look globally and you're a business like Philip Morris, it's really, really hard to serve us.
Yeah.
So before I'd condemn anyone, I have to first say, is it even doable?
Sure. We'll talk a little bit about agencies. I'll come back to it a bit later. Let's talk about your move to Philip Morris. So I know this. We've asked you this question before on stage, but it was something of a surprise, I think, to many people when they saw that you were leaving the agency world. But in particular, to join Philip Morris,
I think the harder part for me was to decide to leave Havas.
Okay,
because that wasn't something I'd done a lot of thinking about. I mean, I'd spent 5 years there as chief strategic officer at the holding company level, had gone back as president of PR, then picked up the global collective under David Jones, was working for Donna Murphy, who's the CEO of Health and the other non-creative. She's wonderful and amazing. I had no motivation to make a change, except that, you know, a two-time brain tumor survivor. And so after you have a brain tumor, for the first 5 years after your brain tumor, you're like, will I live or die? So you kind of go about living your life very day to day. And all of a sudden, I got to that second brain tumor. It's 5 years later. You can kind of not really remember the way you feel. And I kept thinking, shit, this means I really am going to live what I want to do with the rest of my life. So that was kind of niggling at my brain. But believe me, I was doing nothing with it. A headhunter called me. And the first thing I did was give her other people's names and laugh at her. Like, yeah, I would go work at a tobacco company. I don't smoke. I'm not interested in tobacco. It sounds to me like a guy's profession. I kept thinking of stodgy men in brown suits and brown shoes. And I also had a reaction, like, I'm going to tell my family this is what I do, and I'm going to upend working for an agency group where it's just perfectly okay. So it was very much a no. And then I went on their website. After I said no, I went on their website, and I looked at it, and I was like, wait, there's nothing about selling Marlboro or selling cigarettes. It was all about smoke-free, and it was all about the vision. And I spoke to the headhunter. I said, you know what? If you want to put my name forward, I'm never going to get called in. I'm going to be way too provocative. I don't have significant experience in the regulatory space other than supervising the healthcare agency. But as you know, healthcare at Havas does not need Marion Saltzman supervising them. Supervising meant showing up for a periodic lunch or dinner to be charming. I had not a lot of role in the day-to-day work. And she called me back about 3 weeks later and she said, they find your CV very interesting. And I'm like, oh, this is not going. And I was like, all right, well, whatever. I never took it seriously. And this started in like fall or August of 2017. I didn't have my first real meeting with them in a real face-to-face way. It was already snowing outside. So it was already just before Thanksgiving, maybe. And each time I met them, I would come away even more enamored. But I was like, there's no way I'm moving to Lausanne. So my family was primarily in Tucson, Arizona, where we have a house where my husband teaches at the law school. An office in Phoenix, which allows me to go home for 1 week of every month. On my own nickel, I'd go home another weekend every month. I'm going to go 24 hours away from home to work in tobacco. Yet these people are really charming, and their mission is really profoundly interesting. And more than once in the search, I called Heidrick and said, just pull me out. They're wasting their money. I shouldn't fly to Europe. It's not a good idea. And they're no, just can you stay in, do us a favor? And I was like, all right, I'll do you a favor. And each time I would go, I'd come back being really more enamored. And then I think it's exactly this week last year, I was lying in bed with this horrible, horrible flu. And they called me and they made me this offer. And I was like, well, so the whole thing had gained momentum without full engagement on my part that I was making a life-changing decision. So, yeah, but also I had done over a 5 month period extraordinary amount of due diligence, and I couldn't find any reason why people were still lumping them in big tobacco or hating them, because here was a company that was taking its discretionary profits and sinking it into an alternative for people who smoke. So I I guess I got seduced by the mission.
Mm, okay.
And then it felt really normal until I got on a plane with 3 suitcases worth of stuff and realized when I landed, I now lived in Lausanne, Switzerland. Mm. Not a logical place for someone with my hobbies or interests or lifestyle to live in. There's no Chinese food delivery at 10:30 at night. There's no 24-hour blowouts for hair. You cannot get your nails done at 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm. The airport is great. It's Geneva. It doesn't go to a lot of places. Mm.
Yeah.
So I've had no cultural shock coming to Philip Morris.
Mm.
I've had Switzerland shock.
Okay. Now, you mentioned Philip Morris, of course, a company that is a target of much scrutiny, is criticized a lot, is often lumped in with big tobacco. How challenging has all of that been in your role?
There is an extreme emphasis at Philip Morris on data and science.
Mm-hmm.
So one area that's been challenging to me is to have to wade my way through the data I need to learn, having to rely on all my senior science communicators to make me smarter about the science.
Mm-hmm.
So the learning part has been very challenging. It is absolutely different than anything I'd worked on. The environment has been less challenging than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
I've had one crazy Twitter death threat. And yeah. When I say crazy, the operative phrase is probably not to be taken seriously, but everything at Philip Morris rightfully so is taken seriously.
Right.
I've had maybe a third of the people I know give me a hard time. Why would you do something like this? Why would you put your talents or your skills or your Rolodex? Some bit tough on me.
Mm-hmm.
But we went to Cannes, and I inherited Cannes as a project. Our digital team had signed on to be at Cannes.
Okay.
And I inherited how do we program Cannes. And I found it really interesting. I'd say 1 in 7 people was negative.
Mm-hmm.
4 in 7 were really curious. And the rest were just neutral and were like, oh, you have free food. And so for me, that was a turning point also because it gave me confidence. I would have never had the nerve. Cannes was not my deal. I inherited it and I programmed it with Jaime Suarez and our digital team. The decision to come to Davos was driven by me and Maura and her team to make it great. But I don't have this fear because I understand what we're here to do, which is to open up dialogues, not to change someone's mind. It's to have a constructive conversation. And B, I don't believe that we should bifurcate our world into lovers and haters.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just need to better quality conversations. So I'm not afraid of a conversation where we're going to get condemned, as long as it's a conversation.
Right.
So I've heard a rumor that someone significant has given a shout out to WHO to start talking with us.
Okay.
It doesn't mean they should love us. Mm. It doesn't mean Bloomberg Philanthropy should love us.
Mm-hmm.
They all have fair and valid concerns.
Yeah.
And we need to address their concerns and we need to talk to them about how we're changing. But if Philip Morris stopped selling cigarettes this morning, nobody's going to quit smoking.
Mm.
We would not make a whit of difference other than really damaging the economies of some countries because we're a significant tax revenue source, significant families. We have something like 88,000 employees around the world and we have farmers and others. So we would disrupt the global economy. But we wouldn't accomplish all of our goal, which is to get people to give up combustible cigarettes.
Mm. Okay. Part of your mission has been overhauling your agency roster? Would you describe it as such?
No, I would say our mission, it's an ongoing mission, is to enhance and improve the quality of inputs we're getting from all of our agencies.
Okay. Right.
We've added agencies. Actually, in truth, we haven't really added any new agencies other than a small agency called Launch PR in London.
Oh, okay.
On some interesting project work. All the other agencies we're working with are agencies that I inherited.
Mm.
We may have changed what they're working on.
Sure.
But as of right now, I don't think anybody's new in the roster.
Okay. And have you had to have conversations with new agencies about whether they will or won't work for you? I mean, we ran a story.
I know we've sparred on this.
And we've talked. We didn't spar.
I don't want to dispute your sourcing, but I will tell you that what people say and what they do might be two different things.
Mm. Do you think they're being disingenuous when they say they won't work for Philip Morris?
No, I think they have enormous pressure from Bloomberg, from Vital Strategies, from Big Pharma, rightfully so, in terms of they have a right to propagate a message about social good.
Mm.
But I would say that people look for creative ways to work to provide workarounds.
Mm. That's what it seems to be like to me, because you have individual agencies who have gone on the record as saying they won't work.
And look, there's a couple of agencies I'd love to work with. I'd love to work with Weber Shandwick. They are absolutely telling you the truth. They will not work with us.
But Interpublic has this group.
Team IX works with
Team
us.
Team IX, which does work with you. So
that's
it seems to be like there's a
and
holding
group. And that's what
I'm
saying to you. But I mean, look, I'm not impeaching the integrity of any. Weber Shandwick has, I mean, I've gone begging. Even this week, I saw them like, would you please? No, they won't. And they won't because they've made commitments to various institutions and clients. And I respect that. It doesn't mean I won't keep begging.
Right.
But I respect that.
Yeah. But you haven't found it a challenge to find good agencies, people to work for you.
So I'm going to be honest. I found it a challenge to make my good agencies get better. I have not found it a challenge to find agencies to work with us. So, I mean, and what we have done is we sometimes focus our spheres of energy with agencies into the places they can actually do the best work for us. So you, for example, reported on historically that BCW, they do a fabulous job for us in Asia. So they are working with us and flourishing in Asia. We've worked with Havas in France historically. They're doing a good job for us in France. We've extended. We now work with the Red Agency out of Australia. So I think that there's no new agencies joining the roster. We work with KEXT, a publicist agency. We've always on and off work with publicists in various roles. We used to work with the CNC side of CNC KEXT. Now we work with the KEXT. So as you can imagine, there's no complaints. I just want to raise the bar across everyone. First of all, I have to raise the bar on my side. Until we're better clients, I can't shake up an agency and say, do better work.
So coming back to the actual work, how big of a concern is it for you in terms of governments that are looking to strictly regulate the smoke-free products you have, in some cases even banning them?
So it's less banning them, it's more not accepting them. It's more the process you go through to be accepted to be able to be on sale. But let's step back for a second. Look, my entire business mission is what I call B to C to R. It's business, our needs, to our smokers and those who love them, to influence regulatory. We need a grassroots groundswell to ensure that regulatory bodies understand and respect the importance of harm reduction. Governments are super important to us. I don't manage our government affairs folks. Mark Firestone, our president for external affairs and general counsel, has a very large, a couple of hundred people, I think, working in corporate affairs, regulatory, and the regulatory. We have a regulatory and science communications arm that's run by Maura Gilchrist that is very strong and very wonderful. Look, governments are at the top of my agenda. Some days I worry about consumers. Some days I worry, when I say consumers, I mean legal age smokers and the people in their immediate worlds. Some days I worry about governments. I mean, we're here in Davos to try to have impact both through the media and through bilateral meetings with those who are in position to regulate. One thing I will tell you, and I'm going to get the data slightly wrong, and it's very un-Philip Morris to give data that's slightly wrong, so I'm urging your audience to bear with us. Plain packaging has been the law in Australia for many years. It's had zero impact in terms of cutting back on the number of people smoke.
Okay.
So I just want to be clear that you can regulate all kinds of things. People seem to want their nicotine. I wish they didn't. I wish that we were in a place where our smoke-free products were thriving and it was leading to people quitting. But we're a long way from that. One in seven people on the planet smoke. I think that's the right number. Certainly over a billion people.
Yeah.
So it's a challenge.
Okay.
It's an opportunity.
Yeah.
And it's an opportunity where governments are going to have to partner with us and the other tobacco / nicotine providers to just be sure people understand what they're getting into when they start and stick.
So, and lastly, I'm kind of curious. So you've brought in some new people into your department, you know, Aaron Sharinian in particular. And you've worked now, you know, PR agency side, ad agency side. You had a long career with TBWA.
Can we not use the word long? Can we just talk about a career?
Substantial.
Substantial. Meaningful.
JWT, TBWA. Yeah. What's the kind of person that you think thrives today in this kind of communications environment?
That question is a wonderful question. It's one that we've really been working on because I've done two things. I've taking people who already worked at Philip Morris, both in comms and in other areas, and brought them into the comms function. Our function's obviously growing. And I brought people from the outside. The single most important thing is resilience, followed by curiosity, followed by a single-mindedness. In our business, it's not a business for dilettantes. If you don't want to go home and nerd out, I mean, to use Aaron's word, nerd out, it's probably not for you. And it doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't make you a bad communicator. But our work requires a certain amount of homework. I mean, I sort of say I took a book home on a Friday, and I earmarked all day Sunday to read this book, and I wanted to learn all about nicotine. I got through, and I'm a pretty good reader and a pretty good student. 9 hours later, with my yellow marker, I'd gone through 40 pages, made index cards, and I would have failed the exam had it been like ninth grade, because it's hard stuff to learn. And I think that, so you've got to be resilient, you've got to be curious, and you've got to be really prepared to really nerd out. And then the last part is you've got to be proud. You've got to be really sure of your choice to work at Philip Morris, because otherwise it's too easy, because lots of times people say no to us, and really what they mean is yes, maybe. And you've got to hear the yes, maybe, and the no, and then zig and zag. A little bit like your question to me about agencies. No, I cannot get the agencies at Interpublic that I have earmarked that I'd like to work on my business to work on my business. That is a true no.
Do you get the sense from people that they're worried there might be a stigma attached to working at Philip Morris?
I actually have a policy. When I make an offer to someone on the outside, especially I brought Jody Soon over with me from Havas. I've recently made an offer to someone who worked with me in the past at TBWA. I ask them to meet with their families and take 1 week and to absolutely, during that week, make a vision of themselves and where they want to be in 10 years and decide if they think a tobacco affiliation is going to bruise them. I had one luxury. You've already alluded to my elderly age. The one luxury I had when I was coming was I had to make a decision. We had to make a decision as a family. Is this what I wanted as my last communications career? I still probably will do something else in my older age. But what I mean by that is I think one really has to think through, if you want to go back and work at the UN, I don't know if you should join us. If you want to go back into the NGO activist space, you have to make some decisions. If you want to go work at a Unilever, I can't tell you you can leave Philip Morris and go to Unilever. So you need to make those choices. So we make the offer, and then I call the candidates and say, do me a favor. Take the time to sit down and say, what's your dream scenario 10 years from now? Look, I hope for our sake and your sake, you're still at Philip Morris thriving and doing everything great. But if you're not, is your vision a vision that this will bruise you? If it is, say no to me.
Sure. I think you've got plenty of acts after this. I'm not suggesting anything to the contrary. Marion, thanks so much. I think you probably need to get on to whatever your next thing is, because we're in Davos and
yes,
I don't
you.
Think we have that much spare time. It's been great to have you back on. Hopefully it won't be another 5 years before you're next.
You need to come to Lausanne and go to our Science Cube, and then we'll do another one.
All right. I look forward to that. Thank you very much.
For our next podcast from Davos, we're joined by Corinne Woods, who is the Director of Communications at the United Nations World Food Programme. Got it right. First attempt.
Well done.
Corinne, thank you for joining us. First of all, how's your week been so far in Davos?
So the week has been very interesting. I mean, I think it's been, for us, it's an opportunity to connect with people in a space and bring our challenges to many people who can help deliver our challenges and help us deliver our challenges. So it's been a very good week of connection. This Davos has felt almost quieter, stiller, and more substantive. And in a world of sort of, often these things feel like speed dating, you know, this has felt much more that it's about embedding longer term relationships and commitments. And so to that extent, I think for us, it's been, we come here to make sure those commitments, those actions, those partnerships with the private sector are really going to help us deliver our aim. And, you know, you probably didn't know who the World Food Programme was, and people listening might not. And I'm the, you know, I'm Director of Communications, Advocacy and Marketing. So you might want to say, well, what the hell is she doing? We should get rid of her, because we don't know who it is. But the real challenge we've got as the World Food Programme is we're like the best business to business. We're the world's largest humanitarian organisation. We last year fed 93 million people. Of the 124 million people who are on the edge of starvation, we're out there. A load of them, we're giving them cash. to go out and buy. Others, we're bringing in food and commodities and, you know, high quality food so that, you know, they can combat malnutrition. But you don't know us. Most people don't know us.
I do know you.
I'm sure you do. But no, I know that's not fair. But, you know, yeah. Lots of people don't. Mm. And the reason is we're business to business. Mm. We have grown. We're $7.4 billion last year.
Yep.
We need $9 billion. That $7.4 billion, more or less 95, 96% of it comes from governments.
Okay.
So...
So there's a big gap then?
There's a big gap. Right. So, you know, it's coming from governments, but we know that if we're going to meet the 9 billion need, yeah. we're going to have to make sure that people know who we are,
yeah.
private sector want to work with us, yeah. either to bring their resources or to bring their expertise to ensure that we're reaching those we need to reach more efficiently.
So the vast majority of the funding is coming from governments.
Yeah.
It's not coming from the private sector.
No.
Why not?
I think probably because we're an organisation whose main focus is to get it done and mm-hmm. get it done efficiently. So in our Saving Lives work, what we're doing is we're out there. We're feeding today 8 million people every single day in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
We're scaling that up to 12 million within the next period.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing the same thing in northeast Nigeria, in DRC, in South Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
And because we can be trusted to do it, we're efficient, we're effective, governments are funding us.
Mm.
And so we get that done. And so our business model has been, we get the funding, we're trusted, we're a great partner, we do it.
Mm.
And so we haven't had a big need to go out to the public, go out to the private sector and say, bring us your resources.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that some private sector partners haven't been incredibly good partners. MasterCard, mm-hmm. a pledge for 100 million meals, that sort of level. Yum, an amazing partner in terms of support for us. DSM. But we haven't done it at scale.
Mm.
But because we've got a growing need, numbers since the Sustainable Development Goals were adopted in 2015,
mm-hmm.
the situation has got worse. On hunger. Zero hunger? We've got to go to zero hunger? Guess what? We're not going to get there if we continue at this rate.
Mm.
You know, we're talking about going up from up to 124 million people from 90.
Mm.
You know, of the people starving. So things are getting worse. Our needs are getting bigger. And that's even before we start on the sort of work of changing people's lives in countries like Peru, mm. like in India, those sorts of things. So we haven't had a need, but we now do. There's a 2 billion gap, and either we can fill the 2 billion gap by great shared value partnerships where a great tech partner can come in and say to us, you can do this more efficiently.
Mm.
We'll help you do that. That saves money.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a few on the boil at the moment on that side. Or by a partner says, we can help you, and we can actually help you with the resources. But in order to do that, and in order to get the money from individuals, we have to brand ourselves.
Mm.
So now, from a kind of pure branding point of view, we're saying, we need people to know we're a great organisation.
Mm.
We deliver, we get stuff done, and your dollar as an individual will make a difference.
Mm.
And so we want to be great marketing partners.
Yeah.
And so that's what we've started to build, is great marketing partnerships with various players to actually build our story out, so both the private sector will come with resources and also individuals.
Mm. Okay. Now, one of the big themes I've often noticed at Davos every year is about how companies here talk about their purpose and their values, and they're trying to help address social issues.
Mm.
Now, surely that is helpful for an organization like yours.
Yeah.
Do you think it's always genuine?
I don't think it's a question of genuine or not genuine,
mm.
but it's about understanding the contribution, understanding the skill set or resources or capacities that a player will have,
mm-hmm.
the private sector player will have. And having clarity on how those will help to deliver to the social issue, mm-hmm. let's call it the Sustainable Development Goals, how those will deliver, and actually squaring up that capacity or skill,
mm-hmm.
that area of expertise, into the outcome that is, say, zero hunger. And making choices and making decisions on that that are commitments to take it through to the end. You know, I think there's a lot of talk, but until you go through the door and have real commitment, and sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's not easy to work out, okay, how can I, as a tech company, really make a genuine difference to the trajectory of hunger, food supply chains, or as opposed to fiddling around the edges? I think sometimes there's that challenge. That takes commitment, that takes some understanding, that takes, for us as the World Food Programme, we're open for business, to work with business, but we have to understand what the business of the business is, to understand how can that help our big challenges. That's a commitment. It's a bit like, you know, you're not going to have a great relationship if you don't actually have conversations and understand who you are and what you are and what you bring to the parties. And also understand the difference, the differences between a UN agency like the World Food Programme and a partner like a MasterCard, like a Palantir, like an Ericsson, and then do that. We've been working with Ericsson for 18 years. 18 years of commitment. Now, if you think how that company has changed, how its vision has changed, you think how WFP has changed. We have been married or in a relationship for 18 years. That means we can really get to the crux of our challenges and work with them to turn those things around. And that's where it becomes interesting. So I don't really want to get into, is it genuine, isn't it genuine? Sure. You have to believe it's genuine, but you have to work at that sort of commitment. In marketing, for example, we want to build our brand out. So we chose Cinema, SAWA, the Global Cinema Advertising Association, as our partner of choice. They have committed for 3 years to work very closely with us to tell the story of both the hunger agenda, the potential lost in the world, to their audiences. Now, that's a very deliberate, very intentional, very thoughtful partnership that will then bring in other partners and actually build things out. Together with them and AT&T and Facebook and Live Nation, we have a council of great CMOs who are helping us think about building those brands. But that's a long-term relationship. So it's not a quick, hey, we can do something cute for you. This is about really understanding what we're doing and working with us as the World Food Programme to say, okay, we can make this thing happen because we can help you think about this thing and bring our capacities. But it's that deep relationship is the only way we're going to be able to deliver.
Okay. So for you, Davos is very productive because you can have those conversations, presumably, with businesses that perhaps you can't have anywhere else.
I mean, so, you know, if we think about our world as the UN, our world as the UN is, you know, my main focus at the moment is how are we sorting out our situation in Yemen or in Syria, and that's where our focus is. And then we then come to places to have conversations about bringing that world, the reality of those furthest behind, into that, into this situation. So Davos is a place where the conversations are ongoing and we can connect. So, you know, we met 3 years ago with actually an NGO, YGL, so the Young Global Leaders, a couple of young global leaders who were setting up this thing called Gastromotiva, you know, kind of about food movements and so on and so forth. We met them 3 years ago. We then did something small the following year and something. And now we're going to move into a multi-year, multi-country partnership. So Davos is also a touch point for how are those partnerships going and where are we going.
So what do you, I'm curious to know, what do you make of the criticism that Davos sometimes receives, that it's kind of a place where businesses come to perhaps atone for the sins they commit throughout the remainder of the year?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe the businesses we work with are the businesses that don't need to atone. And then, you know, because we're having long-term relationships. And I can only look at it through our lens. We're in the business of the poorest, the most starving, the most difficult situations. That's what we're in the business of doing. Davos, this platform, this place provides us an opportunity to connect with the people who can help us do that. It's super practical, you know, it's practical. I'm not going to be philosophical. What else is going on? For us, it's super practical. We're open for business. We're getting partnerships with business. Who can help us get there? And if that's going to happen, the rest of it, the rest of it is the rest of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, all those, if people are doing deals or whatever else, that's what's going on.
The parties. This,
so be it. Life is life is life is life. What we find as a welfare programme, we come in here and we say, these are the deals we want to have. This is what we're delivering. Sometimes we're nurturing them. Sometimes we're having new conversations. Sometimes we think this could be really interesting. It's changing how we think about things. We go away and we say, this is what's going to help us make it. And it's super focused on our end goal, which is that, you know, no one goes to bed hungry. Those people on the edge of starvation are moving away from starvation. And more importantly, you've got communities who are actually building them for themselves, the sort of resilience and the ability to actually have the sort of economic growth. So in some ways, that stuff, that's a conversation, you know, let that conversation happen. It's useful for us. We like coming here and we like the opportunity of a gathering of folks who we can then bring our world to say, help us get there.
Sure. So, yeah. So one other thing I wanted to ask you about, what we're seeing, you know, in this world today, this kind of rise of populism. People seem to want to build walls and barriers and disassociate themselves with people who they think are not like them. There's a, almost feels like there's a rising fear of the other, and perhaps a rise in xenophobia. Does that pose a marketing challenge for your own fundraising efforts?
Well, I think sometimes what you have to do is sort of go to deep root emotions and set the point of connection and not difference.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
I'm British. I, you know, Joe Cox, the MP who was murdered, there's more that unites us than divides us.
Yeah.
That idea is very powerful. So, you know, a simple thing, which is a connection that says, it's not a connection about a Syrian and a Brit or a Syrian and a German, it's a connection over food. So, you know, from a marketing point of view, sometimes we go two levels down and say the connection is here. So, you know, you think about all those kind of people who are like, right, I'm not going to use a plastic bottle, you know, and I'm going to, you know, sort out my food waste and I'm going to recook it and all that stuff. That's not so different from a farmer in Ethiopia who's thinking, okay, this is how I'm going to actually minimise my food waste. Because they're both doing things which are good for the planet and ultimately is going to help with the issues on climate change. And we're seeing the impact of climate change. We're seeing it in some of the communities that we work for. So sometimes actually going to that point and making the connection, the person to person. I was in Azraq refugee camp not long back, looking at our biometrics and how we're kind of selling food and cash to people. I'm walking around being the kind of UN person looking at this. This woman stopped me and she said, do you want to come for dinner? I said, no, I've got to get back to the capital. And I said, but what are you cooking? And she sort of got her chicken out. And I said, chicken, it's the weekend coming up. Do you cook chicken at the weekend? She said, yes. And I said, how'd you cook it? She started describing how she cooked it, and it's something like maloof. And, you know, how she did it, but how her family liked a bit of crispy and how she put it on the fire. And I was like, well, you know what I really like to do? I like to put a lemon inside. And suddenly we weren't, she wasn't a Syrian refugee and I wasn't a UN person. We were just two women having a conversation about how we like to cook chicken. And I think our marketing challenge is to create that moment of connection as opposed to that moment of difference and then do that.
Okay. And then finally, from a kind of personal level, as a communications professional, how do you find Davos?
What do you mean? What does that mean? From a personal level as a community, how
do
I find...
thinking perhaps not in terms of your mission here for the UN World Food Programme, just on a kind of someone who's here encountering this sort of sensory overload that Davos provides every day. What is the experience like for you?
You know, I said the point about speed dating earlier. Sometimes, this is why this year has been very interesting. Quite a lot of, at times, I found Davos to be too much. Too much sort of, you go to a dinner, there's a reception, you're having a conversation, but it's actually just like, hello, 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 nothing.
Yeah. Totally agree.
This feels like the temperature has, well, the temperatures have dropped, but the temperature has dropped. And there's almost been like a point of space and quiet. So I was just talking to a colleague because I was at a reception last night, you know, Gates Foundation goalkeepers. And 100 people in a room, it's 10:30 at night, 10 o'clock at night, we've all got a glass of wine, it's not much food, mm-hmm. and they had six speakers. Mm-hmm. Now, albeit Bono, Richard Curtis, I mean, good right. speakers.
Okay.
But there was absolute focus. Real sort of focus. This conversation we just came from this morning with Alla Meriberat and I can't remember the other two, about kind of young women and that kind of the space around the young and the restless. Not a moment, you know, people were super focused. People weren't all on their phones. Mm. I don't know. I just think that it's sort of honed down and a little quieter. Personally as well, I've been very selective as I come and I think, I'm interested in these conversations. So I'll go to some places and just be interested in the conversations. Mm. But I try to have a line of thought in the interest in the conversations.
Right.
You know, at the moment, I'm interested in how do you work with young, passionate people who are doing incredible things without grabbing them, badging them and owning them? Mm. You know, that's my thought. How do you get a kind of a voice of people which doesn't say it's WFPs, this generation or whatever? So I've been very deliberate on a personal level that I'm just going to listen into these conversations and do that. Mm. So you have to be a little bit like kind of when you do yoga. You cut out the noise.
Yeah.
Just focus on the things that are here. And that you just like, all of that is noise. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, sound and fury signifying nothing.
Yeah.
It's signifying something for someone else, but not for me. Sure. These are the things.
Very zen.
Very zen. That's the way to be. Only way to be is zen.
you're the most zen person I think I've met in Davos so far. I'm impressed. Yeah. Corinne, thank you so much for your time.
Great to see you.
Have a great rest of the week.
Great, thank you. Thanks for this.
No problem.
Welcome back to the Echo Chamber. This is Arun Sudharman. Again in Davos, and I'm joined by Abhinav Kumar, who's the Chief Marketing and Communications Officer for Tata Consultancy Services, TCS. Abhinav, welcome to the Echo Chamber.
Thanks, Arun. Always a pleasure to do our annual catch-up with you at Davos. And, you know, also looking forward to the excellent event that the Holmes Report is organizing later this afternoon.
Yeah. Well, it's an event. Whether it'll be excellent or not remains to be seen, but I appreciate your confidence.
Given the topic you've chosen of communications in the age of rage. And in a sense, it links very nicely back with the theme of Davos this year, which is Globalization for 4.0, mm-hmm. essentially talking about how the geopolitical order is in transition currently, right? Mm-hmm. And between the trade frictions which we see, the shifts in the blocs which are working together, the declining situation for multilateral bodies.
Yeah.
All driven by mm-hmm. The deficit in trust, which is there in institutions and politicians and organizations,
sure.
which has grown and is showing in the political cycles.
And it's interesting, you brought up all those factors, and you've been coming to Davos now many years.
10th year for me, so yes,
congratulations.
It's been a long time.
That's quite a landmark. You are now Davos man. You have become the kind of Davos archetype now.
Not really. I mean, I think it's for us, it's an extremely valuable platform, right?
Yeah.
Because we come here every year. Right at the start of the year, it's a great place to gauge the sentiment mm-hmm. on what's going to happen in economies. We meet so many people from different countries, from civil society, from academia. And for us as a business-to-business company, mm-hmm. a good percentage of our clients are here, right? So it's a great way to start the year thinking about what are we going to be doing together later in the year. And so the conversations, one-on-one conversations, are the most valuable thing to us about Davos.
Sure. But having said all that, and being someone who's been to Davos a lot, all those factors you brought up before, you know, this kind of,
yes.
these threats which the Davos order is facing, that the world as represented by the Davos order
yes.
is one of liberal consensus, globalization, multilateral bodies, and
yep.
they're facing so many threats. Do you feel that more pronounced this year in Davos?
I would say yes. I think a lot of the people we met, many of the CEOs we are talking to, mm-hmm. You know, we put the same question to them on, you know, what's the sentiment this year? What are you thinking of, and so on? And mm-hmm. I think if I am to kind of crystallize that in sort of one statement, mm-hmm. What they seem to be thinking is, you know, what's gotten them so far is not a model which is going to work in the future, right? Mm-hmm. So they're reflecting on on various parts. They're reflecting on their core business model and economic model and seeing, you know, the threat from digital disruptors and how do they need to change their strategy. Mm-hmm. They're looking at the pressure they're receiving from civil society, from their own employees to take, you know, the point on brand activism for them to take positions on political and social issues. Mm. And they think, you know, so the CEO role, the chairman, chairperson role in any company is under a lot of pressure mm-hmm. To do a lot more in many areas. Mm-hmm. And in fact, just a day ago, we hosted a discussion here.
Yep, that I came to.
Which you came to. Thank you for coming. Mm-hmm. Which was exactly on this topic, on, you know, what is the evolving role of the boardroom and the CEO in this age, in managing the brands and reputations of their companies. And it was a fantastic discussion. And, you know, we spoke to the panelists after that, and they said it was a moment while talking on the panel of self-reflection for us as well, mm. right, on what should be our stance on certain issues, whether it's a political development, whether it's a social issue, it's an inclusion issue, it's equity, mm-hmm. etc. So I think that is really on top of the mind for the CEOs and the chairpersons who are here.
Sure. So I'll come back to the CEO activism angle in a little bit. I'm curious just to hear a few more of your thoughts on Davos this year. A lot of talk about how, you know, the absence of political delegations from the US, from the UK, although apparently half the cabinet is still here, from France. Does that weaken or strengthen Davos in your from your perspective?
I think if you look at our perspective, I would say we've had a very productive Davos mm-hmm. because from the business world, a lot of people are here, even better than last year. So we've had a lot of engaging meetings on that side. You're absolutely right in pointing out, I think, one of the things which this Davos will go down in history for is the fact, and in a sense, it plays absolutely into the theme of Davos this year, that the geopolitical order in the world in such a unique position that I guess a lot of the big leaders on the world stage have not managed to make it here. You were talking about it, the president of the United States who came in here last year, which was a big buzz around it since mm-hmm. a president from that country had not come here for, I believe, 20 years or something mm-hmm. like that. The UK prime minister is not here because, of course, she's dealing with the situation on Brexit. Many others. In India, there's an election coming up and therefore, you know, the government and the prime minister and all are involved with that. And, you know, I think several other of the tall leaders are not here. Some are here. I think a lot of people are very interested in hearing from the new Brazilian president who's here. So that's one of the things. And of course, Chancellor Merkel was here and it was a moment for her to talk more about the recent accord between France and Germany struck in Aachen to renew their bilateral relationship and strengthen Europe and the liberal order and which you're talking about. Mm. So I think that absence is certainly there compared to previous years. Mm-hmm. Every year in Davos, usually there's something which is called a star of Davos, right? Which is an outsized political figure whose you know, view or is very current at that moment. If you looked at it last year, it was you know, Prime Minister Modi coming in for the first time. And of course, then the president of the United States also came in along with him, and so they were the two things. If you went back a year, it was President Xi from China mm-hmm. coming in and you know, giving a powerful message supporting the current world economic order. Mm-hmm. The year before that was Justin Trudeau, who had just come into power and, you know, bringing out talking about equality and so on and so forth. So there's always been that. I think if you had to ask people who's that person this year, I guess it's nobody.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. Well, but the business world is here. I think academia, everyone's here from
whatever. NGOs.
NGOs are here, civil society more and so. I think if you look at the forum, they've put an interesting set of co-chairs this year. I think, you know, traditionally the co-chairs for the forum who kind of help frame the discussion around this mm-hmm. have been business leaders, political leaders and so forth. Last year the forum made a substantial statement mm-hmm. By having all the co-chairs as women. Mm. This year, almost all their co-chairs are from their Global Shapers program,
young
which are young people, and they want the young people's view to be reflected,
including
here.
A former refugee.
Yes,
if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, so
it's interesting that point because Davos is very sensitive to criticism. World Economic Forum. I think it's probably safe to say. I mean, I remember writing a story my first time here 6 years ago where I said Davos has a PR problem. And we've talked about this before. There is obviously a lot of
productive stuff that happens at Davos that helps organizations that otherwise would not be able to access this kind of influence and funding? So, for example, I had the UN World Food Programme in here earlier. They need $9 billion.
Yeah.
Davos is a great way for them to make up their funding shortfall. And yet, when you read the coverage of Davos, as a PR person, how do you feel? Because it's just one note most of the time, right? Here's the elite. They're partying while the world goes to hell.
Yeah, I mean, I think your headline still remains relevant as a topic of discussion, that does Davos have a PR problem? And I guess if you talk to the media teams and those who manage the World Economic Forum Davos brand, it's something they need to continuously battle with. I think part of it is because what Davos is misunderstood. Right? Mm-hmm. What Davos really is, it's a platform for assembling people from across the world, mm-hmm. right? It's whether it's business leaders or political leaders, media leaders, civil society. And I think over the years, if you look at it, civil society has been engaged in a much more meaningful way than it used to be, right? I started coming to Davos, one of the hallmarks here was there were always protests. Mm-hmm. When you were going into the Congress Center and so forth, somebody would be protesting against something or the other, whether it's climate or it's an oil spill somewhere and things, through very, very creative displays. Mm-hmm. Last few years, you don't see that at all. Mm. And I think part of that, to give credit to the World Economic Forum, is they took that criticism they've been getting, mm-hmm. and they've engaged a lot more partners in civil society, a lot of NGOs and so forth, and they include in the panel, they include in the discussions, and also if you look at the topics which are discussing, a lot of the issues which are important to them are there in the central agenda. Mm-hmm. Right. Still, I think Davos gets criticism for the fact saying that yes, there's a lot of talk, but does anything concrete happen? Mm-hmm. Right. I would say, looking at it from that lens, as always, the jury remains out on this. Mm-hmm. But if you want to look at it, as always, you can look at some things as a glass half full or a glass half empty. If you want to look at it with the optimist view of a glass half full, the very fact that a lot of these social issues or environment and planetary issues are brought in here, mm-hmm. In one sense, brings them to the attention of people who have vast resources, mm-hmm. Or vast political power to do something about it. And with the pressure they feel with these topics in place, potentially, they start thinking about, should we be doing more here? Should we be investing more here? And you see all of that happening. Like, for example, on the ocean front and plastics and so forth, many companies have announced interesting initiatives. I think a couple of years ago, I think P&G announced their campaign on how they were using plastics recovered from oceans to build their shampoo bottles and things mm-hmm. like that.
Yeah.
This year, Salesforce, who has a lounge down right here, is talking a lot about saving our oceans and other things, and they made big, big donations to organizations there. So, if you're part of Davos and you're engaging in these conversations, I think as an organization, you would feel the pressure that you should be doing more on it, and that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So let's come back to this topic of CEO activism, because as you mentioned, you had a very interesting discussion the other day about how CEOs can and should shape their company's reputation. And you had on that panel, you had the chairman of Tata, and Chandrasekaran, who previously was, of course, the CEO of TCS, right? So your boss in one way or another. And he had an interesting point of view where he said, it's not really about a CEO putting their personal views forward. It's about representing the views of the company. What happens when those clash? Is that CEO then just in the wrong job?
I think that was the important point of discussion in that panel. Of course, as you said, our chairman was there, but we also had leaders from many other companies. So mm-hmm. the chief operations officer of Bank of America, Kathy Besant, was on the panel.
Yep.
Jonas Prising, the chairman and CEO of Manpower Group, mm-hmm. and Kylie, who's the CEO of Reputation Institute,
Kylie, right,
and of
forward.
Course, conversation hosted by David Haig from Brand Finance. Yep. So the topic you're talking about, yes, that was a big question which was put to them, is what do you do when your point of view is at variance with mm-hmm. what your company wishes to bring out? And I think one of the interesting points which was made was that the panelists said that whenever there is an issue which comes out which has which doesn't have a clear answer and has two sides of the coin in debate, the best place to debate it is in their executive committees, right? Mm-hmm. And there'll be different views which come in. But ultimately, there needs to be something called a party line which is chosen.
Mm-hmm.
And when, as collective responsibility, when the management decides that this is a certain position they're taking, then it is the job of the CEO to represent that position, irrespective of his or her personal thoughts on it, because they're playing that role.
Just like now, Brexit. Just like Brexit.
Yeah, I think that was brought over by David Hague from Brand Finance, saying that he had a certain view on Brexit, and of course, you know, it's a divisive issue. He said in his organization, it's pretty much half and half people on that side of it. So the question was, you know, should he express his view there? And if that's his personal view, but doesn't represent half his organization, is it fair to express it? Right. As always, then no correct answer. I think these are very important discussions, very difficult discussions. The one point which the panelists also made was that you need to differentiate between issues. Right.
Mm-hmm.
If there are issues to take a stance on where you can come to a collective position with the management team and you can take a stance, you know, you follow it. But if it's a deep-rooted values issue and you as a person are not comfortable with the position your company wishes to take, then you need to reflect on whether you should be working in that company at all.
I totally agree. Yeah, I completely agree with that. I hope it doesn't mean anything too significant for David Hay at Brand Finance, though, because I suspect his position may be at odds with some of the younger people in his company, potentially. Another question I have for you on CEO activism is one I heard earlier this week. I was talking to a senior executive from a energy company. And this person said to me, you know, I understand CEOs are going to take a stance now, but I can't understand why, for example, you'll have the Salesforce CEO talking about gun control. I would never advise my CEO to take a stance on an issue that has nothing to do with our company. And I'm curious to know what your view is on that kind of challenge.
I think that was a topic which was discussed on that panel again. And I think one of the mature views which came out was that the panelists believed that the CEO of a company, when they take a position on something, it needs to be relevant and material to their business or the issues which are connected to their business, right? For it to be relevant, authentic, and for it to make sense to their stakeholders. It's entirely possible that CEOs as individuals and human beings, you know, often we see them as CEOs, but they're human beings, have personal convictions on various other issues. But I think one of the things is, if you do take on a job, if you take on the job of a CEO, then the responsibility which comes with it is different than what it is there for a layperson. So, you know, a layperson can express their views as they freely should. As a CEO, any view which you express, in a sense, is seen as the view expressed by your company.
Yeah.
And therefore, you have to be very, very careful about it.
Yeah. Okay.
Having said that, yes, there is so much pressure on CEOs today. As you said, whether it's from civil society, whether it's from their own employees wanting them to take more more of a stance on various things.
And one of the things Chandra said was, you know, we're very clear, we will never advocate for a political party. Right?
Yes, which been the position of the group.
Sure, and it makes a lot of sense, right? It's not only in India, but everywhere, it makes a lot of sense. But I think we're reaching a point now where you are going to start to see CEOs asked who they are supporting in a particular election. And I'm not sure all of them will be as disciplined as Mr. Chandra was.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak for, you know, our group, and we've taken that position historically throughout our 150 years of history that we are apolitical as a business. So, you know, we do not comment on or support any particular political party. And of course, as a company which has always supported the national interests of the communities we operate in and the countries we operate in, we work with whichever political party is in power and in government to on a range of issues. And I think as a business, it's a value which has stood its test in time for us, and you know, we firmly believe that that's the right thing to do.
Okay, Abhinav, thank you so much for your time. As always, it's a real pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Always a pleasure to have a conversation with you. You asked me a lot of questions. Can I put one to you?
Absolutely. Sure.
All right. So for you, you know, you called me a Davos veteran. So are you. You've been here every year. You've been, you know, participating in so many of the conversations and discussions. What was the one standout session or conversation or you know, a corridor conversation or whatever which struck you the most this year in Davos? What are you going to take back as something which you're going to reflect more on?
Good question. And putting me on the spot a little bit. I'm going to pull out my phone because I want to make sure I get this person's name correct. A session I went to in the Female Quotient Lounge, which featured a coder from MIT. Mm-hmm. And I know her Twitter handle is Jovial Joy, but that's not her full name. Her full name, in fact, is Joy Buolamwini. Mm-hmm. She's the founder of the Algorithmic Justice League. She's a Ghanaian-American. She gave a talk about how she's fighting algorithmic bias. You know, there's bias in algorithms. I know people think that because algorithms are purely mathematical, they're free of bias, but they're right. not. Right?
They're not, because algorithm is a program, and right. a program is written by mostly by human beings.
And usually that code is written by white men, right? So that's one of the issues. And she was talking about how this has real implications for particularly women of color, because they're not often recognized by these algorithms. And even men of color, it's a similar sort of thing happens. And the other thing I loved is she delivered her talk via the medium of spoken word poetry, which sounds somewhat esoteric, but actually it was remarkably impactful. She was so passionate, and she was full of optimism, despite this being a really difficult challenge. Yeah. And I thought it was, I really enjoyed that. And it was so different, honestly, it was so different from the typical Davos session.
Yes, and I think that, takes us back to the original point in our conversation, that there's so many new thoughts which come out at Davos.
Yeah.
That this is part of the value it provides. It's a great platform for people like the lady you mentioned to bring up an issue which a lot of people would have no even idea that such a thing even exists.
Yeah.
And bring it to the attention of people with significant resources, with significant political power, with significant influence, with significant projection power with its media.
Yeah.
To highlight their causes and issues. Yeah. Right. So I think while Davos has traditionally been the meeting ground of business leaders and political leaders, mm-hmm. increasingly I think there's so much cause-based activation here, and that's good for Davos, that's good for the world, and we hope to see more and more of it.
Yeah, and it's an interesting point, isn't it? Because people often refer to Davos as a bubble, and yet I think if you have the right attitude, you can be exposed to a lot more here than you would back in your normal everyday life.
The bubble is probably your headquarters back at home.
Right.
Right here, this is the world is here.
Yeah.
You hear so many different and diverse views. I think and that helps you always grow as a company or as an organization.
I need to stop now because I don't want to be on the record being this positive about Davos. So anyway, we'll close the conversation.
I should apply for a media job with the World Economic Forum if I've convinced you to be positive about it. All right.
Thanks, Abhinav.
You've been listening to The Echo Chamber, brought to you by The Holmes Report and produced by Marketeers. Sponsored by The Bullet Group, putting you in tomorrow's conversations today.